Anatomy and Physiology, the Urinary System, Part 2. So in the last section, we broke into some renal physiology, but now we're really going to get into it deep. And to understand some of the renal physiology coming up next, you have to understand a little bit of histology. Let me also back off here a minute and say, renal physiology sounds tough, and it is tough. This is one of those things where you're not going to be able to go home right after you hear this and tell Uncle Bob, oh, I know everything about renal physiology. Let me just give it to you all right now. If you were anything like me, you had to look at this, you know, 4, 5, or 6 times to finally get it down. And if you're not able to connect the dots, so to speak, that's when you need to contact me. So here we go. Let's look at some histology, because histology will help us understand physiology down the road. Here we're going to look at the histology of the renal tubule and the collecting duct. Remember, the renal tubule is part of the nephron, the main functional unit of the kidney. But the collecting duct is equally important in my mind. As a matter of fact, if I invented or named this whole thing, I would have made the collecting duct part of the nephron. But I didn't get to invent it or find it, so we just got to go with the flow here. They both do a lot of work in the kidney. What I want you to do here is picture yourself as a molecule of urine. Let's say you just got filtered out of the filtering ball and into the tubule. And I want you to look at the lining of the tubule, kind of like looking at the inside of a garden hose, right, that has a lining. Because you're going to see special epithelial cells that have a special structure that has a special function. That's the beauty of anatomy and physiology. The first place I want you to stop is in the proximal convoluted tubule that many people, by the way, just call the PCT. Because if you stop in the PCT and look at the cells lining it, you will see lots of microvilli. Why? Because microvilli, we already learned, massively increase surface area. And if you increase surface area of something, you increase the ability of that to perform work, and you improve the efficiency as well. And we're going to see that the PCT is going to do a lot of work. We'll see in processes we'll discuss later, such as especially reabsorption and some secretion. Then I want you to flow as urine. I want you to flow through the loop of Henle, go down the descending limb, go up the ascending limb, go through the distal convoluted tubule, and let's stop next in the collecting duct. Take a look at the walls there, because lining those walls are two major groups of cells with the two major functions of the kidneys, it turns out. First, there's a cell called a principal cell. I love that name. The principal cell is the principal cell that has the main job of the kidney, which is help to regulate fluid balance, blood volume, and therefore, if I regulate blood volume, I regulate blood pressure. So that's the principal job of the kidney. How specifically do the principal cells do it? Because this is where we have special protein receptors for our old friends ADH and aldosterone. This is where those chemical hormones will bind to receptors on these special cells and tell those cells how to regulate our blood volume, fluid balance, and pressure. The next cell I want you to know is the intercalated cell, shown here off to your left. The intercalated cell helps to do the other major function of the kidney that I like to talk about, which is help regulate pH. And again, how do we do it? With a little P and a little H. Because the intercalated cell regulates pH by regulating two major ions. By the way, I use that as a memorization technique. I think I for intercalated cell, and that cell regulates two ions. The first ion it regulates is hydrogen ion, which you know represents acid. So the intercalated cell helps us to secrete or pee out the acid. That's like one of the main jobs of the kidneys. The other ion that the intercalated cell adjusts is our old friend, our weak base, our buffer, our bicarbonate ions. And the intercalated cell can tell the kidneys, hold on to, the term for that is reabsorb, hold on to the weak base bicarb buffer, and that's going to help me to neutralize or buffer the acid in my body. So the intercalated cell is a smart cell that you need to know. Here we get to the details of renal physiology. So let's do an overview of renal physiology, starting with this basic slide. I want to start at the top by telling you what your book did in the figure. What your book did is it took the nephron, right, the ball in the tube, and the collecting duct, and it just unwound it. It straightened it out for simplicity's sake. And it also took the matching blood supply. Remember the blood supply that we studied that matches, it intertwines with, and is intimately applied to the ball in the tube? Well, they just took all the blood vessels you already studied, and it just straightened it out. So don't let this confuse you. It just unwound it to make it simpler to see the processes. Because the big picture, one more time, is this is where we're going to have the exchange of the goodies and the baddies. And we want to try to keep the goodies in the blood and the baddies in the urine, so to speak. So let's get to it. To produce urine and help maintain homeostasis of blood volume and composition, nephrons and collecting ducts perform three basic processes. Let's start right there. I got that sentence, bolded and highlighted and starred. The first part of the sentence says, we are not making urine for fun. We're making urine to regulate homeostasis. Because if I can adjust what I put out in my urine, I can adjust what I keep inside my body. Second part of the sentence, let's break it down. It says nephrons and collecting ducts. That's what I was saying earlier. Collecting ducts do a lion's share of work as well, along with the nephron. I know the nephron is the main functional unit, but believe me, collecting ducts do a whole lot of work with it. What are the three basic things they do together? We'll do them one at a time in order. On this slide, a quick summary. The first thing is glomerular filtration. And I love names in anatomy because the first name is telling me where the action is and the second name is telling me what the action is. In glomerular filtration, the glomerulus is going to filter fluid from the blood. Step number two that we'll look at is tubular reabsorption. In tubular reabsorption, the tubule is going to return the goodies to the blood. Finally, tubular secretion is step three, and the tubule is going to secrete waste products into the urine. That's a quick overview, a short, nice summary. Let's look at some details you need to know. First, we'll do glomerular filtration. This is where the filtering ball is going to do the filtering, quite honestly. We need to know, of course, a more technical definition of glomerular filtration, and it's given here. Glomerular filtration is where water and most solutes in blood plasma are forced across the capillary walls of the glomerulus and into the glomerular capsule. Notice I say the word forced. Make sure you underline that. Then fluid that enters the capsular space, that liquid that we put into these cups, so to speak, someone gave that a name, of course, and that is called glomerular filtrate. So that's the basic definition of glomerular filtration. We need to know some more details, however. I titled this slide, How We Filter, kind of put it more in layman's terms. How does the filtering ball filter? Well, it all goes back to Starling's law of the capillaries. If you've already did that in your vascular studies, I'm sure you don't want to do it again. But let's cut to the chase here. I want you to know that blood pressure is the main, overwhelming, driving force that produces the glomerular filtrate. It would serve you well to know that these are high-pressure filtering balls. As a matter of fact, if I were to put a blood pressure gauge and stab it into one of my capillaries in my arm and measure it, and then take a blood pressure gauge and put it into these capillaries here in the glomerulus, it would measure almost twice the blood pressure of any other capillary in the human body. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but the point is these are high blood pressure filtering devices. That's how they are designed to do their job. You also need to know something called the glomerular filtration rate, which is typically abbreviated the GFR. What does that mean? It means what it says it means. It's the rate at which we produce glomerular filtrate. It's the rate at which we produce glomerular filtrate. And you should know the number. Again, I'm not big on numbers, but this is one that will come up in the hospitals. Average adult human being, the GFR is 100 to 125 milliliters per minute. That means every minute we put about 100 to 125 milliliters of filtrate into our kidneys, into these cups, into these 2 million cups. Let me take that a step further for you. I did this math. That means in a 24-hour period, the average adult human being puts between 40 and 50 gallons of filtrate into these cups per day. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of liquid, isn't it? And this number will come up in the real world. You'll measure this. You'll learn how to measure it in your patients. And when it drops to a certain level, you'll say to your patients, well, now, unfortunately, Mr. Jones, you are in renal failure. And now you are at a level where we may have to recommend a certain type of dialysis to you. Or now you are at a level where we may have to recommend kidney transplant to you. So, yes, you've got to know this number. This is also fascinating to me. The other number I asked you to memorize for my course was the average adult human being puts out about 2 liters or 2 quarts of urine a day. Let's think about that. We're putting 50 gallons of liquid into the cups every day in our kidneys, but only 2 liters gets out the end of the hose, so to speak, at the end of the day. So my big picture question to you to think about is, what's happening? I mean, if 50 gallons is getting filtered out into your kidneys per day, but we're only putting out 2 quarts a day, what's happening? The big picture is, A lot of something, a lot of work must be happening. And those of you who looked ahead know that a lot of reabsorption is happening. A lot of returning the goodies, that good liquid back to our blood must be happening really soon and really quickly. It has to, or we'd never live to make it to another day. A few more details here on glomerular filtration. And I titled this slide in layman's terms, What We Filter. In other words, what gets forced across the glomerular capillaries under high blood pressure? To understand what we filter, you must understand something very important called the filtration membrane. So here's what your book did. I'm going to take my arrow like a knife. I'm going to cut through one of these glomerular capillaries. I'm going to suck it out, blow it up really big, and expand it off to the right on this slide. And here it is. So what do we have here exactly? Well, we have the glomerular capillary, but remember, what are those foot cells that are walking all over my glomerular capillaries? Those are our old friends called podocytes. So that's what we're seeing, a 3D expanded cross-section through. So let's study the filtration membrane and see what we filter. The filtration membrane, in short, is a three-layered leaky structure that only blocks three things. The layers are, one at a time, from inside out, and I'll animate this on the PowerPoint. Number one, boom, there comes a drop-in green line to the glomerular capillary endothelial cell, shown in yellow, which you know lines the inside of our capillaries, but in this case, it's special. It has these holes in it that looks like Swiss cheese, but it's not called Swiss cheese. Those are called the pores of the glomerular capillary endothelial cells, and they're really leaky. Everything in your blood gets through them except blood cells, and platelets. Then all the blood that gets through those holes in the Swiss cheese will encounter the second layer of the filtration membrane that I've highlighted, called the basal lamina of the glomerular capillary wall. And if you studied capillaries, you know that the last layer, the outermost layer, is just this thin grayish-blue layer of collagen connective tissue fibers. And that is called the basal lamina. And all that stops is large plasma proteins. Everything else in your blood gets through it. Then we encounter the third layer of the filtration membrane that I've highlighted. That is called the slit membranes of the podocytes. I want you to think of it this way. Imagine this foot cell. I take my hand, and I imagine my hand is really a foot. And instead of fingers, I have toes on it. And I take my hand, and I put it right on my forearm, and I grab my forearm. My forearm is the capillary. And I just picture now that I have webbed feet. Okay, I have webs between my toes. Those aren't really webs. Those are the slit membranes of the podocytes. And what does that pink layer in this figure stop? Only one thing. Only the medium-sized proteins. Not the very small ones. Everything else gets through. So look, these are three really, really leaky layers that only stop three things. The first layer, the pores, only block blood cells and platelets. The second layer, the basal lamina, only stops large plasma proteins. The third layers, the web feet or the slit membranes, only stop medium-sized proteins. So at the bottom of the slide, I got a big question in bold red print. So what does get across? This is the big picture. What is getting forced across these leaky capillaries under high pressure? You should write down here pretty much everything. I mean, everything gets across. Water, ions, nutrients, waste products, vitamins. I mean, this really doesn't block very much. That's why we're putting 50 gallons of liquid into our cups every day. Some of you are saying, okay, I can remember three layers, block three things, that's easy. I'm a big bad A&P student, but I'll never see this again in real life. Well, you will in real life, and maybe on an examination, because here's what I'll tell you about a disease called diabetes. Diabetes hammers our capillaries in multiple organs, including especially the eyes and the kidneys. In the kidneys, what happens is diabetes destroys the podocytes, so they wither on the vine. They fall off. They shed, so to speak. So we lose our slit membranes, don't we? Diabetes also hammers on, it ruins the basal lamina. And so that layer becomes ineffective. So on the test, I could say, you have a bad diabetic patient with kidney disease, which has ruined the podocytes and the basal lamina of the filtration membrane. Therefore, what substance may you now find in their urine that you should not find in a normal patient's urine? I know you're all going to say sugar comes out in a diabetic's urine. That's a gimme. But what I'm getting at here is, what I'm getting at here is that they're going to also now urinate protein. It's called proteinuria. It just means protein in the urine. And we're not supposed to pee out protein. We kind of need protein for our bones and our muscles and our cells. So you can tell when a diabetic has rather advanced disease, when they start urinating out protein, that means they have kidney damage. So yes, this is real life useful stuff. Let's move on to the second step of renal physiology. The second basic process is tubular reabsorption. The definition is tubule cells remove useful substances from the tubular fluid and return them to the blood. I just remember tubular reabsorption means return the goodies to the blood. Some students tend to flip-flop this on the test, so what I did is I put a red box around tubular reabsorption. I emphasized this with my own big red expanding arrow showing you the proper direction. What I do here is I picture myself as a tubule cell. and as a tubule cell, I look up into the tubular fluid. And I see a lot of good stuff in there. Water, ions, nutrients, vitamins, etc. And I say, wait a minute. We just dumped everything out in the hopper, but I need all the good stuff back. My job as a tubular cell is to return it to the blood. And if you remember from just a few moments ago, there are special cells there with microvilli in the proximal convoluted tubule, right? The PCT. And that surface area provided by the microvilli allows those cells to do that work, to suck in all that good stuff from the urine and put it back into the blood. That is the job of the tubule cells that perform tubular reabsorption. You should know with 6 stars that most of it occurs in the PCT. Most means more than 50% occurs in the proximal convoluted tubule. As a matter of fact, as urine continues to flow down the tubule and through the collecting duct, by the time the tubular fluid reaches the end of the collecting duct, that I abbreviated CD, 99% of all the water and most of all the useful substances are returned to the blood. It has to be, or else we wouldn't live. I know it sounds kind of weird. Step number one in glomerular filtration, we just pretty much dumped everything out here into the hopper, so to speak. Step number two was we took it all back. I know that sounds weird or different, but I'm just a messenger and I'm just delivering that to you. So that's how it works. Let me talk a minute here about diabetes because it's a common disorder you'll encounter in healthcare. In diabetes, they have so much sugar in their blood that gets spilled into the urine that the cells that are responsible for trying to return it to the blood, they get overwhelmed. They just can't keep up with the amount of sugar that is placed into the urine. So those patients have glucosuria or glucose in the urine. That's one way to tell if someone's a diabetic by seeing if they have sugar in their urine. Because, again, the tubular cells just get overwhelmed and they can't keep up. The last step of the three basic processes of making urine is tubular secretion. The definition here is tubule cells remove waste products and other substances that are in excess from the blood and secrete them into the tubular fluid. I remember it easy. I just remember it. Tubular secretion means secrete to the sea. I don't know about you, but when I was a kid growing up, my mommy and daddy told me when I flushed the toilet that all that stuff went out into the ocean, right? All out into the sea. I'm not sure that's really true. I think it goes to a waste treatment plant. But anyway, that memorization technique works for you, for me, and maybe your parents told you the same thing. So tubular secretion means secrete the waste to the sea. So let me be more specific here. Let me be the tubule cell again. In this situation, if I'm a tubule cell responsible for tubular secretion, in this case, I'm looking down at the blood vessel that's right next to me. In class, I usually stand up, I look down at my feet, and I pretend I'm standing on a capillary. So I'm a tubule cell looking at the capillary, and I'm saying, wait a minute, there's still waste products in that blood. And my job as a tubular secretion cell is to kind of fine-tune this whole process and make sure I get the waste products out of the blood. So I look down at the blood capillary, I suck out all the baddies, and I put it into the urine where I can secrete it to the sea. One major example of tubular secretion is secretion of hydrogen ion, which you know represents acid. That's a big function of the kidneys. That's a big function of those intercalated cells in the collecting ducts, is to make sure I'm sucking the acid out of the blood and putting it in the urine and flushing it out to the sea. This is a great summary slide. I was hesitant to do this. I try not to use a lot of slang or layman's terms on my slides because I'm afraid my boss is going to look at my slides one day and say, what in the world are you teaching your kids? Well, I just did it here because I want you to make this easier than it is, not harder than it is. What are the three steps in English? Number one, glomerular filtration, where essentially we just dumped everything out into the hopper, didn't we? We put 50 gallons into all the cups of everything, the good and the bad. Then we did step number two, called tubular reabsorption. In tubular reabsorption, we pretty much immediately took all the good stuff right back and put it into blood where it belongs. And then finally, we did the fine-tuning, step number three, called tubular secretion, where we took all the bad stuff and secreted it to the sea. So tubular secretion, secreted to the sea, out with the bad. So in English, you dump it all out in the hopper, step one. Number two, you take it all back. That's the in with the good. Number three, out with the bad. Secrete the waste products to the sea. But learn the technical names for the test and you'll get it all right. And plus you'll just have an understanding that you can retain for the future this way. So those were just the three general processes of how we produce urine. But now I'm going to get a little bit more specific. I'm going to give you a specific example of how those processes are used. I'm going to talk about how the kidneys adjust the volume and concentration of urine. Because, after all, homeostasis of body fluids depends on the ability of the kidneys to adjust the volume and concentration of urine. If I can adjust the volume and concentration of what I pee out, I adjust the volume and concentration of what stays in my body fluids. That's the point of making urine, not just for fun. You already know some common examples. I mean, if you have a dehydrated patient, do they make a whole bunch of urine or a little bit? You already know, it's a little bit. And do they make pale, light-colored urine or dark, almost yellow-brown urine? You know the answer. They make the darker, concentrated urine to maintain homeostasis. Opposite example, someone who's fluid overloaded, maybe they're water intoxicated. What do the kidneys know to do? They make a big volume of urine, and it's very light and pale in color. So you already know your kidneys are doing this to maintain homeostasis. But how are your kidneys doing it? I'm going to give you two ways. One of them is on this slide. And if anybody asks you, this is the main way. It's our old friend, one more time, ADH, antidiuretic hormone, is the major key to adjusting the volume and concentration of urine. Remember, I like to think of ADH as the anti-dehydration hormone. My other memorization technique is ADH is the add H2O hormone, right? It's the add water hormone. Technically, the name means don't urinate hormone. ADH is made by our old friend, the hypothalamus, which also starts with an H, by the way. Bang for the buck, hypothalamus is a small but most powerful part of the brain and of the body, in my opinion. ADH is made by the hypothalamus in response to what? Increased blood saltiness, right? High blood osmolarity, or decreased blood volume. That's your classic dehydrated patient. So the hypothalamus sends out ADH, sends into the kidneys where it binds to receptors on the main cell of the kidney called the principal cell of the collecting duct. Remember, the principal cell had the principal job of regulating fluid volume and fluid balance. What does ADH do when it gets there? ADH is a hormone, and when it gets to that principal cell, it literally directs that cell's metabolic machinery to insert a water channel protein called aquaporin 2 into the wall of the principal cell. And I love that name, aquaporin. Aqua means water, and pour means pour. It's just a water pour. And the water pour gets inserted into the principal cell, and then water can move out of the collecting duct, out of the tubular fluid, and into the blood where we want it. Now I got a critical thinking question. We just studied the three basic processes of making urine in renal physiology. did I just give you an example of tubular reabsorption or tubular secretion? Think about it before you shout out an answer. Did we just return a goodie to the blood, or did we just secrete a baddie to the sea? Well, I hope you're all saying to yourself, we returned a good substance, water, to the blood. So this is an example of tubular reabsorption. Here's a figure from your book. I draw a better one on the board, but I'll work with your book's figure. What you got here is up top in pale, we have the renal cortex. Below the dashed line in a pale blue, we have the renal medulla. Here we have the ball and the tube, right? There's our nephron hooking into a collecting duct, of course. And over here to your right is trying to show you the matching blood supply. And so what happens in your dehydrated patients is ADH comes down from the hypothalamus, binds to receptors on the principal cell of the collecting duct, causes that cell to insert a water pore, a water channel, a tunnel where water can get out, and that water goes into the blood where we want and need it. So maybe that animated figure from your book helps you visually understand that a little bit better. This figure is nothing new. It's nothing different. This figure your book tends to use a lot. If your brain is like my brain, it doesn't work good with these figures. But we all learn things differently. So if this jives with your brain, you can study it and use it. If this does not work with your brain, if your brain is like my brain, first of all, I'd be afraid. Second of all, you can just tear this figure up. There is nothing new here if it doesn't help you. Is ADH the only way that your kidneys can adjust the volume and concentration of urine? And, of course, the answer is no. There's another way. I'm going to give you one more, and it's on this slide. I will walk you through the slide verbally first, then I'll do it with some animated PowerPoint from a figure from your book that I've greatly embellished to try to make it make sense. It goes like this. Here's the setup in your kidney that you have to know. The concentration, right, the osmolarity, the saltiness of interstitial fluid particles, solutes, such as urea, such as sodium chloride, increases significantly as you go deeper and deeper and deeper into the renal medulla. In other words, as you go deeper into the renal medulla, it gets saltier. How do I remember it? Here's my corny technique. I picture a kidney shaped like a kidney bean, and you got that little divot, right? You got that hilum, and I just picture that's kind of shaped like a bite mark. So I take a bite in the hilum, that's deep, right, in the medulla of the kidney, and I just remember it's really salty there, like anchovies. That way I never forget that the deep medulla is salty. Next bullet point is key. The descending limb of the loop of Henle is permeable, that means leaky, to water, but not salt. And as that descending limb dives deeper into the salty medulla, the higher osmolarity of the interstitial fluid sucks more and more and more of the water out of the descending limb by reabsorption, by specifically osmosis. So what I'm saying here, the bullet point is, water and water only is getting out the descending limb of the loop of Henle. How do I remember that so I don't flip-flop it on the test? I just remember water runs downstream, right? When water gets out of the river and into the sea, the way the water gets out is by running downstream. That's how I remember water runs out the descending limb. What about the ascending limb of the loop of Henle? It is permeable only to sodium and chloride ions, but not to water. That's right. Sodium chloride is actively removed. That technically means reabsorbed from the tubular fluid in the ascending limb of the loop of Henle. Again, in English, salt and salt only is removed from the ascending limb of the loop of Henle. So what? That leads me to the big point at the bottom here with double stars and bold print. This sets the stage for independent regulation of water and salt. Notice we can move water independently through one side of the limb and salt independently out the other limb of the loop of Henle. Usually in the human body, when we've had these discussions, salt and water are moving together. This is one of the rare places in the human body where it has been beautifully designed to move water only if needed and salt only if needed. Therefore, the kidney has a magical ability to regulate the volume and osmolarity of our body fluids because we can independently adjust how much water and or how much salt we place in the urine. That really is truly almost miraculous. You will hear this referred to as something called the countercurrent mechanism. Why is it called the countercurrent mechanism? You need to know. Because if you notice in the loop of Henle, in one limb, the water goes down, and the other limb, water goes up. Same thing with the vasa recta. In the matching limbs, in one side, the blood goes down, the other side, the blood goes up. And so someone said, oh, well, the current is running in opposite directions. That's what countercurrent means in Greek. What's the take-home message, though? Your book gets into a lot of nitty-gritty of this, but I'm going to cut to the chase and try to put this in understandable terms. The countercurrent mechanism is a beautiful design because you should write down it works much more efficiently and can do a lot more work. The example I like to give is if you're a car person like me, into, you know, Mustangs, Corvettes, that sort of thing. You looked at car radiators. You know what the radiator looks like. You've seen how the coils loop back and forth, making hairpin turns, right? If you're not a car person, maybe you looked at the air conditioner coils in your house. Maybe you changed the air filter and you saw the coils. And you saw those coils just like hairpin loops, winding and snaking back and forth through those fins. And there's a reason for that, because some genius physicist, some engineer realized that that design allows the radiator or the air conditioner to do its exchange much better, much quicker, much more efficiently. You know, an air conditioner and a car radiator, they exchange heat and cool. Here we're exchanging good things and bad things. And so the design perfectly matches the mission once again. I'll try to do this using this figure from your book. I animate it, embellish it, and highlight it. So here we go. The setup is we have the cortex up above, and we have the medulla down below the dashed line in pale blue. Here we have our ball and our tube and our collecting duct, along with the matching blood vessels. The setup is, remember, please, the osmolarity of interstitial fluid in the renal medulla gets higher and higher and higher the deeper you go. Your book shows it going from a level of 300 to a level of 1200. I don't care. Don't memorize the numbers. Then, the descending limb of the loop of Henle, I just put a blue box around, is permeable only to water. Water and water only gets out that descending limb, and more of it gets reabsorbed by osmosis as it sinks deeper in the salty medulla. Then, the ascending limb of the loop of Henle, I got a nice, beautiful purple box around, salt and salt only gets reabsorbed or removed from the ascending limb. Again, the magic is, the beauty is, your kidney can adjust very efficiently the volume and concentration of urine, therefore the volume and concentration of your body fluids, by independently regulating movement of water and salt. It's gorgeous. On the next two slides, I pulled some tables from your book. I know that the lab manual has this information in there. The lab and the lecture are co-requisites on purpose. I'm not going to read these to you, but I know there's a urinalysis lab. I wrote part of that lab manual. But I do want you to know from my lecture course some of the key normal and abnormal constituents of urine. And the good news for you is I've highlighted them all in red on this slide. On this slide, you should know, once again, the average amount of urine that a human being puts out, 2 liters a day, about 2 quarts a day. Then I want you to skip down here to pH. Your book says the average pH range of urine is 4.6 to 8.0, but I want you to focus on the average number, which is 6.0. Is that a little bit acid or a little bit base? You should know this. That's a little bit acid. And that should make sense if you're looking at the big picture. What's like the major second, at least first or second major function of the kidney? Get rid of acid. Your body's making acid all day, every day. If you don't get rid of it, you don't live to the next day. So it makes sense that your urine is normally a little bit acidic. You're peeing out a little acid. So yes, that should make sense to you. The other thing I have a little star on this slide is to maybe help you in your clinical future careers if you go into healthcare. Bad diabetics, if they're really sick, you'll notice they have a fruity, kind of a stale, stinky, fruity odor in the urine because of something called ketone bodies that they produce. I'll talk about them in detail on the next slide, but once you smell it, you'll never forget it. You can almost diagnose diabetes just by smelling their urine in some cases. On this next slide, I have listed some of the abnormal constituents of urine. The good news is, watch, I have drawn a line in the sand once again. I just want you to know the ones that are above this pink line. Starting with protein. If I ask you if it's normal to put protein in the urine, I want you to say no. I know your book says a little bit of tiny pieces of albumin, yeah, okay, that might happen. But anything more than that is not normal. We're not supposed to pee out protein. We kind of sort of need it for our body, don't we? And the name for protein in the urine, I want you to know, is proteinuria. That's on another slide. I also want you to be able to name a common disease that can cause proteinuria. I've already given you one. I'm giving you another here. The truth is, any disease that hammers the kidney capillaries can cause damage to the filtration membrane and cause us to have proteinuria. Lupus, high blood pressure, diabetes, I could go on and on and on. Pick one and memorize one for the test, but you should know at least that little bit about proteinuria. What about glucose? Is it normal to pee out glucose if I ask you on the test? You should say no. Your body loves glucose. It's the cellular fuel of choice. If someone has glucose in your urine, you will tell me the name is glucosuria. It means glucose in the urine. It ain't rocket science. If I ask you to name any one common disease that can cause glucosuria, I hope you all will pick diabetes. Next one I want you to know is blood. Is it normal to pee out red blood cells? Of course it's not. We're not supposed to pee out blood. The name for erythrocytes or red blood cells in the urine is hematuria. It just means blood in the urine. You should know at least one common disease that can cause it. Many students pick kidney stones. You could also pick trauma. You could also pick cancer. But pick one and know it for my course. The last one I want to talk about is ketone bodies. Is it normal to have high levels of ketone bodies in the urine? The answer is no. It's called, by the way, ketoneuria. It means ketone bodies in the urine. The common disease I want you to know that can cause that is diabetes. It can also happen in starvation. It can also happen in the low-carb diets you're hearing about in the news. I want to take a minute or two to kind of go a little bit off here. You're not responsible for it, for my course, but it's interesting. It hooks to real life. It's clinically relevant, and you may know some people like this. Let's talk about ketone bodies. First of all, ketone bodies are acids. I do want you to write that down. You should know that ketone bodies are acids. But now the rest of this is for you. Have you ever heard of someone who was in DKA? If someone is in DKA, that means they are in diabetic ketoacidosis. These are usually very sick type 1 juvenile diabetics. They come into the ER sick as a dog. Their blood sugar's through the roof. But that's not what's going to kill them right away. What's going to kill them right away is the acidosis from the ketone bodies in their blood. Because you live in a tight pH range, and if it's a little bit off, you do not have long for this world. Here's how it goes. If I'm a type 1 diabetic, my problem is I can't make insulin. And I love the word insulin. Insulin is a hormone we'll study that's made in your pancreas that causes sugar to be driven in to your body cells from your blood. That's why I like insulin. Insulin drives sugar into your body cells from your blood. But if I don't have insulin, then I can't get the sugar out of my blood and into my body cells where I need it. So that's why I have high blood sugar. Now the problem is your body cells ain't getting the sugar and your body cells need it. But your body cells aren't stupid. Your body cells will say, I don't have sugar, but I don't feel like dying today, so I will switch to my next fuel of choice. And the next fuel of choice is fat. And when your body starts burning fat as a byproduct, it makes ketone bodies, which are acids. And if they get too high in your blood, again, it can kill you. So that's exactly what happens in a diabetic. And where do you admit those people in the hospital? Do they stay on a regular floor, the step-down unit? Do you leave them in the hallway for 5 hours waiting like I was the other day with a friend of mine? No. They go to the ICU stat. Because if you don't fix their metabolic abnormalities, their problems that they'll have with acid and potassium and so forth, they're going to die right in front of your eyes. One semester I gave this talk, and a girl sitting in the front row, she raised her hand. She said, my brother, was 30 years old. He just died last week from that. I was like, oh my goodness. You should be able to diagnose it, treat it, and save their lives. Another reason where this will come up is in those low-carb diets. You might know someone on a low-carb diet, right? That's where you can eat all the fat. You can eat all the meat you want. You can have a whole slab of bacon. You can eat the whole cow. You just can't put the bun around the cow, right? No, you got to cut out the carbs. Well, the person who invented those diets, you know, they were smart. They knew this metabolism. Their goal was to switch your body to fat metabolism, right? Burn off the fat. Burn off the spare tire. And if you've known anybody on that diet, they're told to go to the store, go to the local store, no prescription necessary. You go buy these dipsticks for urine. They're called keto sticks. And, you know, you pee on the stick and it measures the level of ketone bodies in your urine. Because the goal of the diet is to switch your metabolism to fat metabolism so that you will therefore produce ketone bodies that are detectable in the urine. You know, you're kind of walking a fine line, though. I am not disrespecting that diet. I know that for the right person, the right way, that it's helpful. I'm just saying this for educational purposes purely, okay? Don't take it out of context. But you're kind of walking a tightrope, aren't you? You want to put yourself in a little state of ketosis, but not enough where you're in dangerous ketoacidosis like that bad diabetic patient. So in my mind, the patients could be walking a really fine line with those low-carb diets. If you don't believe me, you could do an internet search on those low-carb diets, and at the same time in that search, put in acidosis or kidney problems, and you will get a bunch of hits. It just makes sense if you understand the physiology. You're taking this course, I hope, not just to get an A. I hope you're taking this course to help people. And someone who understood this physiology said, I'm going to try to help somebody. I'm going to invent some drugs that will help with high blood pressure. I'm going to invent some drugs that will help take fluid off of people who have edema. So someone invented these drugs called diuretics. I mean, uretic kind of sounds like urination. And diuretics are drugs that make you urinate. The slang is water pills. The technical thing is these are substances that slow reabsorption of water and cause diuresis. Therefore, they increase the urine flow rate. They're water pills. How do most prescription medicines work? A lot of them will act either on the loop of Henle or the distal convoluted tubule, and they will inhibit the ability to reabsorb or hold on to salt. And in general, if you can't hold on to your salt, you can't hold on to your water, and out it comes. What about caffeinated beverages? Are they good to rehydrate your dehydrated patients with? And the answer is no, because caffeine actually also inhibits sodium reabsorption in the kidneys. If it can't hold on to your salt, you can't hold on to your water, and out it comes. Likewise, are alcoholic beverages good beverages to hydrate with? And the answer is no, because alcohol specifically blocks ADH. And if I don't have enough ADH, remember, I can't hold on to my water, and out it comes. Those of you on the weekends who know people who drink a lot of alcoholic beverages, you may notice that they have to use the bathroom a lot. That's because alcohol is blocking ADH. And you didn't think you were learning anything useful today. There you go. Some more clinical significance of what we're studying here today. What happens if nephrons are injured? Remember, once a nephron is whacked, it don't come back. It's just like a neuron. So you get what you get at birth. You get 1 million in each kidney, and if you have an injury, you don't get any more. But check this out. Let's say my brother had kidney failure, and I wanted to give him my left kidney. Could I give him my left kidney, and could I still live a normal life? And the answer is yes. Why? Because my remaining right kidney, what's it going to do? Is it going to grow new nephrons? Answer, no. But the nephrons in that one kidney, they're going to almost double in size, and the whole kidney is going to almost double in size. And my one kidney is going to be able to filter blood at about 80% of the rate of two kidneys. And I put a star next to that in red on purpose, because 80% is good enough. What I'm saying to you, in English, as a critical thinking point, with age, with drugs, with disease, with donation of a kidney to somebody, we can lose 20% of our renal function and still live a fairly normal life. Also, for those of you who are going into ultrasound or radiography, if you do a scan on someone who has donated a kidney and you find out that their remaining kidney is doubled in size, please just don't automatically tell the person, oh my gosh, you have a kidney tumor, because chances are they don't. Chances are it's just the normal enlargement that you would expect to see. Whenever I get to the slide, it always amazes me that somebody who's just an absolute genius has invented a machine to take over the duties of the kidneys, which we barely scratch the surface of. People invented the dialysis machine. You may have seen the blood dialysis machine. People go there, 3 days a week for several hours a day. Very stressful process on the patient and the family. There's another way to dialyze people that's kind of fascinating to me. And believe it or not, you can clean somebody's blood through their belly. Remember when you studied the peritoneal cavity and the peritoneal space with the peritoneal fluid? If you go into nursing, you're going to be trained how to do something called continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis. That means you're going to put a catheter into somebody's belly cavity, and then you're going to run a bag of fluid, looks like an IV bag, and you're running into their belly, into their peritoneal space. You're going to let it sit there for a bunch of hours, and then you're going to have a clamp that you're going to undo on a separate hose, and you're going to drain all that fluid out of their belly into a waste bag, we'll call it. Because the peritoneal cavity is so big and it's lined with just, thousands and thousands of teeny tiny capillaries, if you ever look at the peritoneal lining inside your cats, you'll see, billions of capillaries everywhere. So that's why someone figured out that you can dialyze or clean somebody's blood through their belly cavity. Again, it's just the same old story. It's in with the good, out with the bad, but rather than the blood machine, you can do it through their belly. Finally, we'll end up with some much lighter material. The ureters, they're about a foot long. They do extend from the renal pelvis. They go behind the peritoneum. That means they're retroperitoneal. And they enter the backside of the urinary bladder wall. This is a great slide, gross anatomy slide, to orient you on the location of the urinary bladder. You should really have this image ingrained in your brain. It will help you now, and it will help you in reproductive anatomy and with your patients. Check this out. This is a female cadaver that was sawed in half in a sagittal section, a mid-sagittal section. Here's the bony pubic symphysis anteriorly. Then comes the urinary bladder. Then comes the uterus. Then comes the rectum. By the way, I have a little mnemonic for that. It goes bladder, uterus, rectum. So that spells BUR, right? B-U-R. That's kind of a word. Or if you don't like that, you can do it from the back to the front, because you got rectum, uterus, bladder, and that spells RUB. And you certainly don't want to rub things the wrong way when you see this on the test question. So get that mnemonic in your brain. And also, this picture will help you understand why pregnant women always feel like they got to go to the bathroom. Look, you got the baby stuffed inside the uterus, and that's pressing down on the urinary bladder, squashing down on the bone. So they always feel full. They always feel like they have to go to the bathroom. So this is key anatomy. You've got to know this. Here's a slide where we hacked the urinary bladder in half. We're looking at a cross section. A couple of bullet points on this slide. Number one, the bladder is just a bag of smooth muscle. In general, it has an average capacity of under a quart in most adult human beings. The internal anatomy I want you to know on this slide is this special flat, smooth, triangular floor of the urinary bladder that someone has called the trigone, because it's shaped like a triangle. And it is bordered by the two ureteral openings and the single urethral opening. I can't believe I said that right. But that forms your triangle. And why am I picking on that piece? Because it just so turns out bladder cancers tend to form there. The theory is that carcinogens settle out by gravity on that triangular floor, and that's where cancers start to grow. By the way, bladder cancer more common in smokers and alcoholics. And when the pathology report comes back to your desk and says, Mr. Jones has a tumor of the trigone, if you didn't know what and where the trigone was, you'd have no clue what's going on with your patient. Now you know. Some more basic anatomy. Here again, we have the bladder sawed in half. And I hope this is starting to look like a little bit of old news to you. We got three layers in the wall of the bladder. We have an inner mucosa, then we have the middle muscularis, and outer layer, which includes the covering called the peritoneum. Let's break it down. Look what's in the mucosa. We have transitional epithelium. In A&P earlier, you may have learned transitional epithelium has the ability to stretch. Again, this is where the design matches the mission. Likewise, the bladder, the urinary bladder, like the stomach, has folds called rugi. Again, the rugi allow the bladder to expand, so the bladder can go from a smaller to a larger size as it fills up. The third special thing inside there, we have mucus that covers the mucosa, and the purpose of mucus, you know, is to protect. And there are some, you know, harsh chemicals and waste products inside the urine. There's acid in there. And so it's good that we have mucus to protect us. As far as the muscular layer, know it's called the muscularis. I also want you to know that the name of the muscle, the name of the smooth muscle inside the bladder wall is called the detrusor muscle. The last slide is labeled the micturition reflex. Wow, that's a mouthful. It just means how we go to the bathroom. We go to the bathroom by a reflex. Micturition, by the way, is a synonym for urination. It means the same thing, which is a synonym for voiding. You may hear the nurses and doctors on the floor use all the names interchangeably. All depends when and where they went to school. But micturition equals urination equals voiding. So how do we pee? It's on this slide. You can read the words, but I'm just going to say it in layman's terms. When the urinary bladder is about half full, stretch receptors in the wall of the bladder send signals to the micturition center in sacral spinal cord segments S2 and S3, And S2 and S3 says we got to pee. It triggers a reflex where parasympathetic fibers carry their electrical signals to the detrusor muscle, and it causes the bag, right, the bladder shaped like a bag, contracts. At the same time, the bag squishes. The urethral sphincter muscles relax. They open up to allow the urine to come out. So again, bladder's half full. Signals go to S2 and S3. S2 and S3 says we gotta pee. The detrusor muscle squishes the bag, the sphincter muscles open, and out comes the urine. So you're thinking, wait a minute now, how come we're not just all going to the bathroom now? Well, because we also have signals that get sent to the brain, and the brain tells us that our bladder is full, and we can control the reflex before it actually occurs. What about little kitties, however? Do they have this neuromuscular reflex all figured out and developed yet? And the answer is no. And that's why, of course, the babies have those pee-pee diapers for a while. So yes, once again, I hope you're finding out that this is real life stuff. It's useful and real in the world. Don't just memorize it to get an A on the test. Memorize it because you want to learn it and help people.